I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome back to Radio Times. We all have our pet peeves when it comes to online behavior. I'm always amazed and frankly a little bit irritated when someone is shouting into his or her phone about some private personal matter on my crowded commuter train. We ask our guests to put away their phones during the interview and some just can't resist a surreptitious text or tweet. And don't get me started on texting in the movie theater. But we love our digital technology because it connects us to the people and events in our lives and to the larger world. So how do we navigate our analog and digital worlds? Joining us is Daniel Post-Senning. He's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, author of a book called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. He's also the manager of web development and online content at the Emily Post Institute. And Dan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Marty. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to our listeners, and I'm sure we're going to hear from a lot of people, give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dan, is the philosophy behind good manners different for the analog world from the digital world?
You know, I certainly hope not. I got involved in the etiquette business because I was born into it. Emily Post was my great-great-grandmother. And one of the things that we've learned at the Emily Post Institute from the perspective of a five-generation family business that talks about etiquette is that the fundamentals, the absolute heart, the core of good etiquette stays the same as the mediums change, as the world that we live in evolves around us. The specific manners that we employ might change, but the real concepts, the heart of the matter, that you treat people with respect, with honesty, with consideration, that you think about how your actions affect others, that's the heart of the matter and remains the heart of the matter.
The golden rule, really. Treat others
Absolutely.
The way you want to be respected, to be treated.
Exactly.
But what I find so interesting, and I'm guilty of some of the behavior that I've criticized other people for.
We all are.
Is that social media, you know, smartphones, first of all, you know, they're in our pocket, they're in our purse, they're so convenient. There's that sort of desire for that instant connection, that instant ability to be able to communicate with somebody else.
It is so true. They're incredibly powerful tools, and they're also, for many people, incredibly familiar and almost safe environments. It feels very normal. It feels like something I do all the time to take my phone out and to start to interact and engage through it. Of course, the danger is that becomes a habitual action, that it becomes a cell phone security blanket, that whenever you're in a new or an unfamiliar situation, out comes the phone because it provides some comfort. And it's important to retain and maintain a real broad and diverse communication diet so that you don't lose the ability to interact face-to-face with a stranger on the subway or at a restaurant.
It almost feels very Skinnerian, which is, you know, based on my behavioral psychology of many decades
sure.
ago, which is, you know, you get reinforced and you have to respond to that behavior. And in many ways, that's what social media and certainly smartphones do.
Absolutely. We're all programmed to habituate actions. In fact, the classic science example for a programmed response is Pavlov's dogs.
Right, exactly.
You ring a bell and feed a dog. Ring a bell, feed a dog. Pretty soon you just need to ring a bell and the dog mm-hmm. starts to salivate. Literally an automatic response to a bell ringing is the most common example of programmed biological response. And what is a phone except a little mm-hmm. ringing bell that follows us around almost all the time now?
I wonder, too, about what all this technology has done to this, what used to be, you know, private behavior was over here and public behavior was over here, and now it's all intermingled.
The intersection of the public and the private, it really is changing things quite fast. And we talk about it used to be that the revolutions that happened in our communication environments were separated by years, sometimes hundreds of years.
Right.
And the revolutions in communication are happening faster and faster and quicker. So we have this situation now where kids are oftentimes equipped with cell phones that have the ability to send information to potentially billions of people in an instant.
Well, I remember years ago doing an interview about the history of the telephone. I know that sounds pretty dated and probably pretty boring to a lot of people. But one of the things that stayed with me was that when the telephone was introduced to the family, the critics said it's going to ruin family life. It's going to ruin mealtime. You know, that phone ringing in that central hallway is going to be the ruination of the American family. Somehow we figured out how to deal with the telephone, the landline.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing it up, because it really, I think, brings some perspective to the discussion. Sometimes we get asked at the Emily Post Institute, you know, are kids ruder today? And I say, you know, my grandmother got asked that same question. And you're describing an episode or an incident in the evolution of communication that my great-great-grandmother had to deal with, when the phone went from being an office phone to being in the home. And back then, there were party lines, and there was etiquette and manners around how you answered the phone, whether you listened in on your neighbor's conversations. You obviously didn't. But every generation has had new communication manners to suss out and to figure out what are best practices. And we're just maybe dealing with more of those more rapidly than ever before, but it's not something brand new. It's definitely something that has happened before and will happen again. And there's some comfort to take in that the fundamentals really do stay the same as we skip along the surface of these different communication mediums.
What's the most common either complaint or question that you get?
So for operating in social media or digital spaces, the most common complaint that we hear is about the overshare. And it really takes two forms. There's the overshare that's information that's just too private or personal to be expressed or shared that publicly. So it might be more recently, as people are sharing more bad news about death or illness in the family. And sharing that before you have a chance to tell people personally, to tell close friends and family, either in person or over the phone, can leave people with really hurt feelings. So that's a very specific example of an overshare that's just too private for that kind of public forum. But the other type of overshare that we hear a lot about is just the volume of information. So if you're in the habit of giving your email or friend list over to every new app that you engage, and people are getting a lot of promotional material or information from you that is maybe from you, maybe isn't, or maybe you tweet about your lunch every day, but everybody in your office doesn't really want to see that picture of your lunch every day. It becomes another type of spam. We're all challenged with filtering and sorting a huge volume of information that flows around us, and figuring out what matters among all those streams of information is one of the tasks that we all have today. So part of a new courtesy, part of being a new good digital citizen, is helping the people that you're connected with by not barraging or bombarding them with information that isn't going to matter to them.
You know, it's interesting. I'm surprised that's the most, or the number one issue that you have to deal with, because I kind of figured it would be how it feels to talk to someone and they're on their cell phone while you are talking to them.
Okay, so and it's funny, because my first topic was really addressing behaviors that occur in those digital spaces, but then there's also the behaviors when we've got that mobile device in our hand, how we interact with the gateway to those spaces in the real world, the physical world. And absolutely, people using their cell phones, not giving attention to the people that they're with, but giving their cell phone primacy in terms of their attention, is absolutely the biggest complaint we hear about mobile phone use.
And so what would Emily Post or Emily Post's great-great-grandson say to do about that?
Well, first of all, model the behavior that you'd like to see, because we all do it. AP Ipsos did a study a few years ago, and they asked, have you witnessed someone using their phone in a rude or annoying manner in the past few months? And a full 89% of people said they'd seen that kind of rude behavior. But when they flip the question on its head and ask, have you used your phone in a rude or annoying manner, only 8% of people will cop to it.
Oh, interesting.
I'm going to suggest that those 8% aren't responsible for the bad behavior that the other almost 90% are witnessing, that it's easier to see rudeness in others than ourselves. So my first best advice is always to apply that critical lens to yourself and to your own behavior, and model the behavior that you'd like to see in the world. Of course, we're all going to do that from now on, so what's the next step? if you are expecting a really important call, or if you anticipate being pulled away from the people you're with, just giving a little warning ahead of time, showing that forethought and that consideration for the people you're with. You know, I'm going to be getting a call from my boss at some point today, and if that call does come in, I'm going to have to step aside and take it. It's a great way to warn your friends before a social lunch that you're not assessing every call that comes in and trying to prioritize how those are important, balanced against the actual company that you're sharing with others, but that you're really giving that company primacy and warning people ahead of time. Ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure.
I'm sure everyone has seen this. I certainly have, where a bunch of people are together. Everyone is on their cell phone or their mobile device of some sort, either Googling or maybe they're even, you know, texting each other. I'm not sure. And sometimes it looks awkward. And frankly, sometimes it looks like they're having a great time.
Sure. One of the examples that came up recently at a seminar I was giving in Chicago, I mentioned that I'd taken the train and from the airport, and that literally every person on my car had been engaged with their device. And this was a full train car. And people in the room expressed this was the type of behavior they saw all the time. And someone expressed a little regret that once upon a time, particularly when the Bulls were just an amazing basketball team and were winning all the time, you'd get on a subway in Chicago and there would be a lively discussion among and between strangers about the basketball team. And that really helped build and foster a sense of community in the city. Now, it might be that everybody on the train is having the same conversation, but they're all having it through their phones with people elsewhere. And it really reminds me of that stage in development when children are doing parallel play instead of cooperative play, where I've got my truck and I play with it, and you've got your truck and you play with it, and we sit next to each other doing that. But there's a level of sophistication that comes when I say, hey, I'm going to take my truck and hand it to you, and you're going to give your truck and fill it to Sand and give it back to me, that is a more sophisticated, more developed type of play. And getting away from that parallel play into that cooperative play is something that I don't want to see us losing collectively. So there's a balance to strike, and I'm not saying that everyone needs to put their phones away. I love my phone like everyone does. But finding that balance and maintaining it, I think, is really important.
Because I have seen groups of people who seem to be very fluid about it. So, yes, everyone's on their phone or their device, but there is a lot of sharing and back and forth and handing things around, and it actually does look like they're having a conversation. It's just that you've got all these devices in it.
And engagement, and in many ways that enriches the interaction, and definitely put me in that camp of folks that really wants to encourage and promote a really broad and diverse communication diet. Having lots of tools at our disposal really empowers us to make choices that are good choices. So what is a good choice? We often talk at the Emily Post Institute about the heart of etiquette being building good relationships. And if you keep your attention on the relationship that's being served by the communication technology, it's going to help you make all kinds of choices that are going to come up instantaneously that there might not be a specific rule or standard for. So I like to say, think about the relationship. The phone itself isn't rude. It's not polite. It's how you use it that matters.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open up the lines as well. We are talking about etiquette online or netiquette, as the word is used. And our guest is Daniel Post Senning. As he told us, he is the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, author of a book called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon, about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past, starts Friday.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about some of the guidelines when it comes to polite online behavior or netiquette. And again, our guest is Daniel Post-Senning, author of Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dan, I'm sure you heard about the New York Times writer Nick Bilton posted something complaining about behavior that he called rude. I'm assuming you've heard about this. One of the
Absolutely.
Things, so let me ask you, he complained, in fact, he called people rude who just emailed or texted thank you. And I think it's after an interchange and you're kind of finishing up the interchange and it's all done. And then you get a response that says thank you. And he says, that's rude. Is it?
Well, from Nick's perspective,
okay.
It felt rude. He was thinking about just the volume of information that he's sorting every day, that first type of overshare that we talked about. Now, this is an example where I think the importance of the message really supersedes the concerns about the volume of information. Giving and receiving thanks is such a core and fundamental part of good etiquette and has been since my great-great-grandmother's day almost 100 years ago. And we often say that part of giving thanks is also part of the whole process of giving thanks is the process of receiving thanks, and that you receive thanks with a gracious spirit, mm-hmm. the same generous spirit that they're given with. And one point I like to make with folks broadly is that magic words really are magic. And just like we learned thank you when we're little children, we also often learn you're welcome. And that your welcome is really important because it acknowledges thanks. It's not a you're nothing or it's no trouble or no problem. It acknowledges the thanks, and it's really important that you're welcome is part of our vocabulary also. And it's important that we retain that you're welcome in the digital world. It doesn't mean that you have to reply to every thanks that you mm-hmm. get with a you're welcome or mm-hmm. no thank you. In fact, at some point, the thank you chain ends. You don't
exactly.
have to thank someone for a thank you note, for example. Just in case anyone was wondering out there.
Right.
But retaining that spirit of receiving thanks graciously is an important thing to retain as things move faster and faster. And even if that's just that I put eyes on it and I acknowledge it and I'm not resentful that they occupied my time. At the same time, if I was someone who communicated with Nick Bilton on a regular basis, and I knew that one of his real challenges was just the volume of information, and that he doesn't appreciate that thank you, doesn't necessarily want it in the context of the business that we're doing, I would respect that choice of his. I wouldn't try to force it on him. And that's a little bit about mm-hmm. thinking about the relationship that you're serving with a type of communication. I might figure out a way to thank him more broadly. Maybe Nick gets a handwritten note just to take it up a level for the larger work that he's done getting all of us to think about appropriate thank yous.
Well, and he says, you know, and perhaps I should be talking to him, but nonetheless, you know, he got a lot of response to this. He seemed to be saying that texting is more polite than leaving a voicemail message. What do you think, Dan?
Sure. That's something that we've heard quite a bit about from digital natives and even some millennials. It was fun. I actually spoke with Nick about this piece that he wrote on the Bits blog, so I've got some familiarity with his thinking on this issue. And it's not... frankly, it's representative of a generation and a way a generation thinks that the voicemail takes too long to listen to. They'd rather get the information in a text. One little etiquette tip I love to give folks is that if you're giving someone directions, today many people love to get the directions that you're sending in a text. Even if you talk to someone on the phone, if you follow up your phone call with a quick text, mm-hmm. then they've got the address that you know right there. They can copy and paste it into their navigation program or... So anyway, texting directions, good little tip there on top of everything else. But for Nick, with texting versus voicemail, I would respect that when I'm talking to him. At the same time, I don't not listen to voicemails that people leave me, because if they've taken the time to do that, I think it's important. Mm-hmm. And they might have left a message that is of value to them, to me. So I give them the respect of listening, but I also give respect to people who I know prefer just to get a quick text or to know I called and that they'll call me back.
You mentioned thank yous, and I'm kind of a stickler for thank you notes, showing probably my age here. But does a thank you note via email, is that as good as one through snail mail, handwritten versus, you know, writing on your keyboard?
As good. I would say different thank yous are appropriate for different situations. And if you want to give your thanks some real weight, maybe a physical note, a handwritten note sent through the post is the best way to do that. It becomes a physical, tangible message. The medium itself becomes part of the message. It says, I've taken the time to get out a pen, to think about what I'm going to say, and to write it by hand, to put some postage on it and send it to you. It might be the only piece of personal mail that someone receives in a month or several months, even a year. So it really gives your thanks weight. And I would advise handwritten thank you notes are still really good for gifts that you've received, meals that you've been treated to, and as a follow-up to interviews that you've been given, or even if someone's helped you to get an interview to get a job. You really want to give that thanks some weight. But, you know, a quick email thanks to someone who's just interviewed you, if you're part of a fast-track decision-making process, might get to that person and be registered in time and in ways that the handwritten note that follows up and maybe doesn't get there for a few days might not. So for different situations, or maybe I'm thanking a colleague who I've been going back and forth with via email, and really a little email thanks when we're done our business is the most appropriate way and then the most effective and economical way to thank them.
What do you think about Evites? And I'm thinking about, say, an Evite for a wedding, you know, which is one of the most dramatic thing a couple can do.
It's another great example where we still really advise that for your wedding invitation, you think about a printed invitation. For all of the reasons that we just said, it really gives more weight. The decision to employ that medium becomes part of the message. A wedding invitation in particular, because it carries with it a little bit of expectation. When people are invited to a wedding, they are often going to reply with a gift. And because of that expectation, and that expectation comes from a tradition that is much older than the Evite, and it's likely that there are going to be people that are invited to your wedding that are more familiar with that tradition than they are with the Evite, that by employing the printed wedding invitation, you engage that tradition in ways that are really important, because people will read different messages into that. Your grandmother might not understand an Evite, and
True. It
might not register with her in the same way that the printed wedding invitation does. It's funny, you mentioned your age, and it's definitely true that there are some generational differences in communication standards, and it's a real challenge in today's workplace, but it's also a challenge in the larger social world that we all work in, and respecting those differences is another really important part of having good etiquette today and being a good digital citizen. And it goes both ways. It goes from young people respecting the traditions that have served society for so long, but it also has to do with people who are more traditional, who have been in the workplace or been in the social world for longer, to understand that there are new standards emerging around some of these new communication tools. And that's normal and natural, and to have a little faith, a little courage, and to know that ultimately the fundamental standards that we use to treat each other well aren't going to change, even as some of the specifics of the way we express those do.
And that's Daniel Post, Senning, and author of a book called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. And again, he is the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, also the manager of web development and online content at the Emily Post Institute. And obviously our guest today on Radio Times talking about netiquette. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Liz from Perkasie has to say. Liz, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much for hearing what I have to say.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm a bank teller, and unfortunately, I see some of the worst cell phone etiquette on a daily basis. And I think that people use their cell phone, and they forget about interacting with the people around them. You know, maybe you put your cell phone down, and you can form a relationship with the person that you see on a weekly basis at the bank or at the supermarket. And that's just all I have to say.
Well, and don't leave us this. So you work at it's a drive-through, you're a drive-through teller, if I can use that word?
Yes, I am. I'm also a college student, so I work part-time at a bank.
Right.
And I just see it every day. People come through the drive-through, and they don't say hi, they don't say bye, they don't say thank you. They kind of almost treat you like a robot. It's almost better for people who are on their cell phones and kind of just give a little wave and, like, acknowledge that you're a human.
And you are a human, Liz. Yeah, absolutely. Let me give Dan a chance to respond. Go ahead, Dan.
Absolutely, and I couldn't affirm it anymore. Now, don't check out on your checkout person. The electronic brick wall that oftentimes keeps us from recognizing or really relating to the humanity of the other person that we're interacting with has started to bleed out of the devices, and it affects the way many people treat people when they're engaged with their device. And the example that you give is one of the most common. It's one of the ones that bothers me the most. It's definitely when someone's talking on the phone while they're checking out, because that is a real person, and they do deserve to be treated with some humanity in some respect. They're not the automatic checkout machine at the supermarket. So we can expand this concept just a little bit to any captive audience, that so often when we're on our phone, we're with other people who don't have a choice. They have to be there, whether we're sitting in a waiting room waiting for a doctor's appointment, there's someone sitting next to us, or whether it's in the checkout line at the supermarket. That when you're with that captive audience, you want to be extra, extra careful. It's hard to ignore half of a conversation, almost impossible. And the other people in the elevator don't need to hear about your gallbladder surgery or even just the banality of what was happening last night between you and somebody else. It's really disrespectful and discourteous. So thank you for bringing that up.
Indeed,
it's a really important point.
Yeah, Liz, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Debbie from Huntington Valley has to say. Debbie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello there. Thank you so much for this topic.
You're so
welcome.
I
have been harboring a bit of ill will to someone who, at my dad's funeral 8 years ago, graveside, took a cell phone call. I couldn't believe when her phone rang. I was stunned when she took the call. I'm looking for a polite way to try and cordon off this behavior in the future. How do you tell guests at your home or at events that, you know, phone calls and texting just is not kosher at certain times?
Debbie, I have to say my mouth dropped when you described what happened at your dad's funeral.
Thank you for sharing that.
No, I did. My jaw dropped.
About it 8 years after the fact.
Well, the fact that just the phone went off and then they actually answered the phone at the gravesite?
Indeed, and said that they were at a funeral, so could they call the caller back? And I must say, every time I see this woman, I bristle at inside, because that memory is so raw to me yet.
Indeed. Well, let me see what Dan Senning has to say. Dan, what do you think?
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
I would be in complete shock, frankly, if I hadn't heard about this kind of thing happening before and even witnessed it myself on one occasion. Although there's a real difference between what I witnessed and what our caller witnessed, which is after the initial rude behavior of the phone goes off at the funeral. And that's going to happen. We all have these devices on us all the time, and people forget. They just do. They forget that they've got that phone. They forget that they haven't silenced it. So we can head off the first problem by give people some warning. When you're starting a meeting, set the standards for cell phone use at the start of the meeting. Let people know there's going to be a 10-minute time at the end of every hour where people can check emails and get caught up on their communication. But you're going to, at the start of, and it's happening in movie theaters now, they don't just ask you to put your phone away. They say, please don't text during the show. A little bit of warning to a crowd can go a long way, particularly when you're in a situation where you know that a cell phone would be inappropriate. Just help people help themselves. But, boy, the behavior where the phone goes off and then the insult is compounded by actually taking the phone out and talking to the person. If you are in that incredibly awkward and uncomfortable situation where you're the one who's forgotten and your phone has gone off somewhere that it really shouldn't, just silence it, leave it in your pocket. If you can, if it's appropriate, apologize and move on. Almost the worst thing you can do is check to see who it is, because that gives everyone the impression that, you know, if this had been some type of call, you might go and take it. Or worst case, the situation that our caller described where this person actually processed the call.
Well, and Debbie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Dan, let me ask you, because she said, look, when she sees this woman today, now 8 years later, she still bristles. Would it be good manners to tell her, you know, I have to say that this has been bothering me for 8 years, or and I know you're not a psychologist, but, you know, or is it just, you know, give it up and move on?
Yeah, boy, you know, it's tough. It's a question that we often get asked. You know, I've witnessed bad behavior. I'm witnessing bad behavior. What do I do? And you usually don't have standing to correct someone else's behavior. Mm. And in a situation like this, I might say to myself, you know, we're all in new territory with these cell phones and mobile devices. And as atrocious as that behavior seemed to me at the time, I'm the eternal optimist. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt and assume that, you know, by now they've learned. If it was something that I was witnessing repeatedly, if I knew it was behavior that was ongoing and continuing, I might apply the broccoli on the tooth rule, which is if you can save someone some embarrassment by pointing out something that's a little awkward now and save them more embarrassment later, you do it.
I like that.
If someone has a little broccoli on their tooth at dinner, you help them out, and you do it in the spirit of helping them out. And you know, ways to have that conversation, you do it in private, you do it when it's not happening, you're not addressing the offense as it happens so that you're not confronting someone about behavior that they might feel really embarrassed about in the moment. You approach them with concern for the way they're being perceived by others. You know, I'd want someone to tell me if this was the way I was looking to someone else. But again, that's a big step to take, sure. And you want to really be careful about it.
Debbie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dan, one of the Radio Times producers told me that she just went to a concert recently in a small venue. And when the performers started performing, everyone ran up front and they held their cell phones up so that they could, I guess, both video and probably audio the concert, and those people in the back couldn't see because everyone was standing there with their cell phones in the air.
It's funny, and I've seen applications for phones that do a visual image of a lighter. It's where people at rock concerts like to hold
exactly.
up their lighter for an encore. Mm-hmm. In many ways, the venue that you're describing is a place where cell phone use has become pretty accepted, that the idea that you would capture a little video at a concert that you go to or a sporting event is pretty common these days. Although a little discourteous to be right up front to make a wall with those phones that keeps other people from seeing. It's definitely something that I am now aware of, just hearing your producer bring it up, that you don't want to obstruct the view for people behind you. It's a little bit like taking off a really big hat or something if you're sitting in a theater. Maybe don't hold your phone up for the entire show so that the person behind you can see what's going on as well.
There you go.
It brings up another point. Recently, a local theater here in Burlington has added a texting balcony section and a tweeting balcony section because they want people to be using social media to promote local theater, and they oftentimes don't sell out, so they've made a special place within the theater for certain shows where tweeting is allowed, with it really designed to encourage conversation about the theater. So this is definitely something that's still shaking out a little bit, and I think really thinking about the people around us is going to be useful as we're in this new territory.
Right? That sounds very Burlington, Vermont to me, if I can say that. No, I think it's great. I think it's great. Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also, we've got a lot of callers that want to join our conversation as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Post-Senning is our guest. He's a spokesperson for the Emily Post Institute. He is the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, manager of the web development and online content at the Emily Post Institute, author of a new book called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including human sexuality, social work, and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theatre Company presents Henry V, extended through this Sunday, April 21st only. Philadelphia's own Ben Dibble takes on the title role in Shakespeare's epic journey through royal courts and battlefields. Following a bloody civil war, charismatic young King Henry sets out to repair a fractured England with a common purpose, war with France. From the rousing speeches to the dark eve of Agincourt, Henry V is a tale of raw power, punctuated by surprising moments of comedy. Information at lanterntheatre.org.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at Wistar.org.
Supporting WHYY, Legacy Recordings. Presenting Willie Nelson's new album, Let's Face the Music and Dance, a new collection of songs from the American country singer-songwriter. Available at Amazon.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get Tracy from Haddon Heights, New Jersey, to join our conversation. And Tracy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
First, I want to say that my mother would be thrilled to know I'm speaking to the great-great-grandson of Emily Post. She would love that. She was very big on etiquette. So I'm a 47-year-old woman. I just re-entered the workforce this year after many years. And I applied online. I responded to a post on Craigslist for a job, sent my resume in. The owner of the business, that's a local retail business, didn't call me or respond to my email. He texted me a message to come in for an interview, which I did. I interviewed with him, and it was for his management position. And then he didn't respond to a follow-up email I sent him or a phone call, leaving a voice message. He texted me a week later offering me the job. And pretty much the job sort of didn't go that well. We had conflicting ideas of how things should work. He was very, very, very big on social media use, which was fine, but wasn't as interested in concentrating on his everyday foot traffic and bringing people in the door in more traditional ways. And needless to say, he wound up firing me and did so through a text.
Mm.
And incidentally, the business closed about a month and a half after I left.
Well, that's interesting.
So I was very offended from the beginning, and I kind of politely told him, you know, that, you know, as we got to know each other, that, you know, he might want to deal with people in a little bit more professional manner. Like I said, he's 24 years old, so I think it speaks volumes about the younger generation and how they're going about their dealings. And for me, I mean, I'm a very hip 47-year-old, and I know how to use technology, and I think it's great, but it's very concerning that people are dealing like this in a business world.
Well, Tracy, let me see what Dan has to say. What do you think, Dan?
Hi, Tracy. It's remarkable. This is something that I hear about not infrequently. And I jump back to that AP Ipsos poll I referenced at the start of the show that really showed that it's easier for people to see rudeness in others than in themselves. If you drill a little deeper into that study, particularly in the workplace, the most likely offenders for making etiquette mistakes on the job are someone who's a senior or supervisor or employee with valued talent, someone who feels protected in their position. And I oftentimes think that, oh, this manner stuff, it doesn't matter to me. And the bottom line is that it matters to the bottom line, that business is built on relationships. It has been forever and will continue to be. And sustaining and growing relationships is really the heart of good etiquette and treating people well. And in this particular situation, part of that treating people well is communicating effectively and being respectful of the types of communication, just reading emails, letting people know that you've received something, even if you're not able to respond to it immediately. We all have expectations, turnaround time, and for different mediums it's different. For texting, it's often very immediate. So to even get texted a week later sort of seems strange, like it's coming out of nowhere at you in some ways. So texting we think of coming back in minutes or hours, email in hours or days, snail mail in days to weeks.
So the part of managing communication effectively in business is communicating through the medium that achieves the time and response that you want. And, you know, just being as courteous as reading the emails that come into you can be a big part of participating well in a communication environment.
Tracy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do you think, Dan, it was a red flag that he hired her by text and then ended up firing her by text?
Absolutely. I wasn't surprised to hear the end of the story when I heard the start, for sure. Although I love the hook that it turns out the boss is 24 years old at the end.
Yeah, she kind of buried the lead there. Tracy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Dan, in this book, you talk a lot about Facebook for all the obvious reasons. It's where a lot of people meet and talk and share information. And you also talk about how, you know, I guess the polite way to defriend somebody. Can you help our listeners on that, and then we'll get back to our callers?
Sure. Participation in any of these systems is not obligatory. These are all opportunities. They're not obligations. So I like to start from that as a jumping off point. And if you ever feel like you're getting out of control or your social media profile doesn't represent you well, it is okay to disengage. It's okay to step back. It's even okay to take a profile down. So managing contact lists is another part of that. And sometimes people feel like they want to reduce the contact list. Maybe they're a little overexposed. Maybe they've gone too far. And they're ready to pull back just a little bit. It's okay to unfriend someone. It's okay to take your profile down. Facebook does change the way that they function pretty regularly. And one of my guidelines for everyone is that you need to know your tools. And at the right time I was writing this book, Facebook doesn't notify someone when they're unfriended. So it's not like a big alert goes out that, oh, you've just been unfriended by this person. And a lot of people will even accept friend requests, and this is a little dishonest. I don't like recommending it. We'll wait a little period of time and then defriend later on, and most people don't even notice that.
Huh. Interesting. Let me get, looks like Sasha from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. And Sasha, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say, sometimes I feel like the last person in the world who has what I call cell phone shame. I try very hard not to take a call in public, but if I have to, I will usually tell the person that's calling me, look, I really can't talk right now. I'm in the store. And I feel stupid doing it, and I also feel like it is kind of exasperating to the person on the other end. Just kind of an interesting phenomenon. And the other thing is, the phone that I have now, I like to call it a B student. I can text, I can take pictures, it goes on the internet in a very primitive way, and let me tell you, I dread the day I have to hold a smartphone in my hands because it's insidious. I mean, the pull of it is so strong, and people are helpless against it.
Well, Sasha, don't be that scared. I mean, be aware, but it's not a toxic material here, but let me give Dan a chance to respond to your call. Thanks for calling into Radio Times.
I'd also like to encourage our caller. In fact, it sounds to me like she's doing just the right thing. She's applying that critical lens to herself and her own behavior. I cut my teeth at the Emily Post Institute answering etiquette questions. Emily's answered all of her correspondence in some form or another for the past 80 years. And early on, I started to figure out the questions I liked answering were questions about the future. And the questions I didn't like answering as much were about the past. And the questions that were about the future, future events, were always someone thinking critically about something that was coming down the road that they wanted to handle well. They were curious to get some advice or some thoughts about how to handle a situation. Anytime someone's thinking ahead, I almost guarantee they're going to do okay. They're going to find that reasonable, common sense solution if they're thinking about what they're doing and thinking about other people. Most of us find that sweet spot where we're able to do something that isn't offensive. It's really the questions that are about something that's already happened or something that was inconsiderate or unconsidered, inconsiderate behavior that are troublesome because it's oftentimes about passing judgment on something that happened or accepting blame. And those can be tougher. So if you're thinking ahead, if you're anticipating what's coming, I think you're in great shape. So I say good luck.
Yeah, good luck, Sasha. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. We haven't really talked about Twitter, but I think we all know that it's the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to Twitter. In certain instances, it's a lifesaver, in also instances, it's a place where people can say horrible things about other people. But there's also the speed of Twitter, and I often wonder whether if people had just thought for a minute or two, would they have sent that tweet or not? What do you think, Dan?
Probably not.
Probably not. Okay, fair enough.
The rapidity of that communication is seductive and definitely draws some responses out of people that I think with a little time and reflection they probably wouldn't have done. It was advice that we've given about email forever. It's really hard to communicate emotional content, so if you're feeling strongly about something, let it simmer. Maybe write a draft, come back to it later. And I'd say the same thing about Twitter and tweeting. If you're feeling really strongly about something, give yourself just 3 deep breaths before you hit send. In Twitter world, that might be forever, but take the time to do a self-reflection and assessment. I would also just mention that because Twitter's been embraced by the journalism community, the reach of Twitter and the impact of Twitter is really great, that it is an incredibly fast tool, but the number of influencers, the number of people that really affect huge media narratives that participate on Twitter is great. So the potential for a message to get amplified in that particular medium is also something to be aware of.
I do want to get back to our callers, but let me ask you about Kickstarter, which is a site where people can raise money for projects, and they put together a kind of a promotion on Kickstarter. And I always think it's asking for money is a very tricky thing to do, and there are obviously, Dan, you know, polite ways to do it and impolite ways to do it. What do you think about Kickstarter?
I'm so glad you asked the question. Up here in Vermont, we have the highest number of Kickstarter campaigns per capita of any place in the country.
Again, why am I not surprised?
A lot of people trying to organize to do a lot of good, and I appreciate it. But with it being so easy to start a social campaign to raise funds, it's really important that we don't lose sight of how we treat people that support these campaigns and funds. My biggest advice to people that use Kickstarter is take it seriously. You're asking people for money, and that's a big deal. It's a big deal to ask. It's also a big deal when they donate. And your willingness to follow up, to thank people appropriately for how they've helped and how they've participated, I think is really important for keeping the whole system functioning, making people feel good about participating so that it continues to be paid forward in a way that people continue to want to do it.
Let me get Kim from Mount Holly to join us on Radio Times. And Kim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I actually have two comments. The first is that I'm a 41-year-old waitress at a fine dining restaurant, and a lot of times we approach the table for our initial introduction, and people have their phones out. So the staff was becoming frustrated, and I found that the best way to handle that was to simply say, "Hey, as long as you have your phone out, make sure you post where you are and the great time that you're having, and then repost about the great food that you've received."
Good for you, Kim.
And that usually breaks the tension, and it also makes them put their phones away. It acknowledges that they have the phones out and they're not paying attention to the person standing in front of them. And then the second comment was that I was recently having a conversation about technology and how people are so involved in their phones with my 66-year-old mother, who was complaining that, of course, that is going to be the demise of this generation, or that is the problem with this generation. And as we were discussing it, her phone went off in another room that indicated she had a text message, and she quickly got up, disengaged from the conversation she was having with me, and was now concentrating on the text message. And then when I said, "Mom, do you realize you just jumped up like Pavlov's dog when that text went off?" And she was like, "Oh, I didn't even think of that."
Well, there you go.
It's I don't think it's a generational thing. I think that we are becoming conditioned to these bells and tweets and whistles that we're rendered helpless when they go off.
Oh, well, Kim,
I
appreciate the phone call to Radio Times. I want to give Dan a chance to respond. I heard you chuckling there, Dan.
What a great story.
It is a great story.
On every level. It is so much easier to see rudeness in others than ourselves, and it's not anything that any generation is insulated from. It can happen to anybody all the time. I also love bringing up the fine dining and the cell phone.
yes.
My cousin Anna likes to point out, you know, there is no place at a traditional table setting for a phone. There's just no place on the table for it. If you were to make a diagram, it doesn't exist. Even if the people that you're dining with are okay with you using a phone at dinner, the people who work hard to maintain the establishment that you're eating at, to create a certain atmosphere and ambiance, they're not being factored into your equation when you take your phone out and use it at a restaurant or in a situation where someone's worked hard to set up an event or experience for everyone. So even if your friends are okay with it, there might be some other people around that aren't, like your server. At the same time, too, I love her solution.
Me too.
Because there's no question that the hospitality and customer service industry are discovering all kinds of ways to use social media to engage with customers and to spread the word about what they do, how excellent their service is, how witty and funny their staff is, how I got taken better care of at this restaurant than I ever have been before. Even when I had my phone out and was using it at the table, they didn't make me feel awkward or embarrassed about it while they reminded me that it was probably best to put it away.
Kim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dan, are you surprised that all of our callers so far have been women?
No, not entirely. In that this work for five generations, Emily was obviously a woman herself. It's funny, though, because in her time, I think if Emily had been able to choose any profession, she would have been an architect. She was incredibly close with her father, Bruce Price, who was an architect of some note, built Tuxedo Park outside New York, a couple of other signature projects, the Frontenac up in Quebec. And if Emily had been a man, she would have been an architect. She was intellectually very close with her father. They were good friends. And I always say that she's a social architect, that she applied his Enlightenment-era values and ideals to her area of agency, the social sphere. And I really like to think of Emily as a social architect. But it is true that many people think of the social sphere in gendered ways and gendered terms. And one of the things that I really enjoy about being a fifth-generation post in a very postmodern world is having the opportunity to challenge that assumption.
Well, on that note, it's been a great pleasure. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're most welcome. It's good to be here.
And that's Daniel Post Senning, the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, author of a book called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online, and joining us from the offices of the Emily Post Institute up there in Vermont. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook, Twitter, email archives, and the satellite radio schedule. Katie Ricciardi, our intern for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us.